Court will now call Claim Physician Group, Inc. versus Kira Wright and Dominique Jackson. May it please the court, Ms. Mary Barkley will argue for the appellant, and Ms. Dana Levy will argue for the appellate.
May it please the court. My name is Mary Barkley, and I'm here. Can you hear me?
I was thinking you might need to speak into the microphone a little more.
Okay. Thanks. My name is Mary Barkley, and I'm here on behalf of Acclaim Physician Group in their interlocutory appeal from the denial of a motion to dismiss under the Texas Tort Claims Act. The issue before the court is whether Dr. Garda, who was an Acclaim Physician employee at the time of the care at issue, was entitled to be dismissed from this alleged health care liability case, because her employer, Acclaim, remains a party defendant. And the answer is yes, because the evidence shows that Dr. Garda was in the paid service, the sole paid service of Acclaim, her employer, at the time of the care at issue, and that she was in the course and scope of her employment with Acclaim at the time of the complaint of medical care. A little bit about this case. Plaintiff sued Dr. Garda, Acclaim, which is her employer, Harris Hospital, and a Harris nurse arising out of care provided during the labor and delivery of plaintiff and their baby. Dr. Garda only encountered plaintiff as a result of her employment with Acclaim. It is undisputed in the evidence that Dr. Garda was in the sole paid service of Acclaim. And the trial court, however, denied Acclaim's motion to dismiss under the Texas Tort Claims Act. And we assert that that's error. The court has jurisdiction over this interlocutory appeal because Dr. Garda and Acclaim are units of local government for purposes of the Texas Tort Claims Act. And because Acclaim remains a party to the case, Dr. Garda should have been dismissed. The plaintiffs take issue with jurisdiction on appeal. Acclaim believed that that issue, that Acclaim and Dr. Garda were units of local government, was admitted to and consented at the trial court level. But just briefly, I'll address it. Acclaim was set up to serve JPS Hospital. In the record, there's the foundation documents for Acclaim Physicians Group. It was set up for the sole purpose of serving, well, at that time, UNT Health Science Center and JPS, and now it just serves JPS. There's no question, there's no doubt in this court's case law that JPS Hospital is a unit, is a political subdivision of the state. And because a claim was set up by JPS, it is also a political subdivision of the state. And if the legislation we've cited for your honors, which includes Chapter 281 of the Health Safety Code, 281.072, 281.0565, both show that Acclaim is a unit of local government. We've set that out in the evidence before the trial court. Acclaim satisfies two different provisions of the Health Safety Code to be afforded unit of local government status. The evidence shows that Acclaim is a hospital district management contractor via the general counsel from JPS's affidavit, as well as the foundation documents for Acclaim that are all part of the record.
But before you move on, you mentioned in your, I guess it was your reply brief, that you believed, or your position was that, and you mentioned it just very briefly, that Appley had conceded certain things at the trial court level. I didn't notice any authority there that you mentioned that basically tells us that we have to then, that we can't look at that. Did you have any authority that says that?
I think it counts as an admission under the authority that I cited in the brief. I can't point to the exact case, but there's a case there insofar as an admission before the court where plaintiff's counsel stated that the only issue really is this course and scope argument.
So I think it was Ledesma.
Yes, Ledesma. And that's just a judicial admission case. I mean, that's
very general.
Yes, it's very
point
general.
Of law.
And but be that as it may, certainly Acclaim established at the trial court and through briefing that it is a unit of local government under the statutes at issue and the constitutional provisions that set up JPS Hospital.
Because obviously, if we didn't have interlocutory appeal jurisdiction, that's it. We're done, right? If you concede that part, obviously.
I agree. Okay. And the merits are somewhat intertwined with the jurisdictional issue.
Sure.
And but we believe the evidence is clear that a claim did meet the standards to be afforded the protection under the Tort Claims Act for unit of local government. Plaintiff makes sort of a parsing of words about the terms governmental unit and unit of local government. We've provided the court with the case law showing that unit of local government is a type, is one of the several different types of governmental unit entitled to Tort Claims Act protection.
Although you agree with the appellee that there are a number of examples in the codes and statutes where governmental unit and unit of local government are used to suggest to a reader that they're different things.
I agree, but in this particular case, the evidence shows that a claim is a unit of local government, which is a type of governmental unit because it was all set up under the statutory scheme and constitutional scheme applicable to political subdivisions of the state, with JPS starting to be one of the political subdivisions of the state, and then a claim as a contractor to JPS is also a unit of local government.
And wasn't, I think that was a Dallas case, correct?
Yes, there are several cases that examine this in different counties. There's one out of Travis County, one out of Nueces County that we cited for the court that sort of examine the statutory setup and conclude that similar organizations set up by a county hospital, political subdivision of the state, is also a political subdivision of the state. And it isn't just the unit of local government definition that gets affords the claim the immunity protections and protections under the Tort Claims Act. It's the fact that a claim and JPS are fulfilling a role that is set up by legislation as well as the Texas Constitution insofar as the purpose of the organizations, which is to serve the needy inhabitants of the county.
Dr. Garden needed privileges to practice at Harris Methodist, did she not?
I believe she did.
Okay. Do you know, or does the record reflect whether or not those privileges were obtained independently by Dr. Garda, or were they imputed to her based upon the agreement between Harris and between a claim?
I do not believe that is mentioned in the record. I believe it's part of the Harris claim agreement that Harris would give acclaimed physicians the right to practice at Harris pursuant to the agreement, and that agreement, Your Honor, is the one that states that there is, or specifically denounces, any employer-employee.
Okay, but does the agreement not deal with the issue of complying with staff privilege requirements, and that would also mean being subject to peer review for care provided at Health Harris Methodist?
Certainly, the agreement between Claim and Harris calls for the physicians practicing at Harris to be subject to the rules and regulations applicable at Harris. But that fact doesn't give Harris the control necessary to exclude a claim's control over Dr. Garda.
So being able and having a contractual ability, okay, to conduct peer review concerning this very care that's made the issue of this claim doesn't give Harris sufficient control over the actual details of the care that was provided for purposes of not making Dr. Garda an employee, but making Dr. Garda actually practicing as part of the Harris staff, and therefore not immunity not being available to her for that.
You know, I don't believe, Your Honor, that I can't speak to whether peer review is part of that agreement. I believe the requirement is that a claim provides physicians to Harris for, in the limited scope of the Harris Acclaim Agreement. They are subject to policies and procedures at Harris, but it doesn't interrupt the independent.
My guess is the Occupations Code is going to speak to that, and that would be specifically infused within the agreement between Acclaim and Harris.
I'd be happy to submit a post-submission
brief. I'll be happy to accept it.
but again, I don't think that the Harris Acclaim Agreement or the fact that Dr. Garda, was subject to Harris's general policies, and this record shows that Dr. Garda's employment relationship with Acclaim was superseded or interrupted by Harris, that Harris could control Dr. Garda to the exclusion of Acclaim. I believe still Acclaim was the direct supervision of Dr. Garda. And it was...
Well, you would agree that peer review is an aspect of supervising the physicians providing care in a hospital, would you not?
I believe so, Dr. Garda. But it's not to the exclusion of Acclaim. And that was what the plaintiff was required to show under the course and scope.
Has there been any case law that dealt with the issue of the subjection to peer review, one way or the other, that talks about control and the right to control?
I don't know that peer review was directly addressed in the Powell case. But the Powell case is the closest one. The Dallas Court of Appeals Powell case is the closest one to our set of facts. And it concluded that case involved a doctor that was a radiologist that was employed by UT Health Science Center or UT Southwestern Dallas, who performed the care issue at Dallas Children's. And that opinion went through, yes, Dallas Children's did have some, you know, rights insofar as its policies and procedures that governed that position while he was working at Dallas Children's, but the evidence in that case was that the direct supervision over that position, Powell, came from UT Southwestern. And so for that reason, the doctor in that case was, even though he was performing services at a private facility, Dallas Children's, he was still entitled to the protection of the Texas Tort Claims Act.
But didn't Appley point out that there's case law that postdates that came after that 3 years later that in essence goes the other direction?
Yes, there is, and but those cases are distinguishable from the facts at bar.
Let me ask you one other question, and I do not. I'm asking these questions because I have a popcorn brain. Okay, so have any of these cases, whether Powell or Marino or whatever, dealt with the Federal Tort Claims Act? Because there's quite a bit of case law on the Gonzales Act, which is similar, but it may be distinguishable on the specifics of the Federal Tort Claims Act. But there's quite a bit of case law over there on the federal side with regard to, for example, Air Force physicians becoming residents at local Texas hospitals and who gets immunity and who doesn't under those circumstances.
I don't believe any of the cases that we've briefed in these briefs address the federal aspects. I would submit to the court that Acclaim has already been afforded and its physicians afforded the immunity under the federal act in a different context, but so no, the short answer is no. Okay. To your question. But we believe, and to answer Justice Walker's question, yes, there are subsequent cases to Powell, but they're factually distinguishable from this one. In this particular case, we have a presumption that an employee remains in their general employment here at Acclaim, with Dr. Garda with Acclaim, even though they're performing in another location. So long as they are performing the general, the work entrusted by the general employer. So in absence of evidence that contract, in this case, Claim Harris contract is a sham, or that there was actual control, which just, there's just no evidence here in this record. In fact, there was additional time afforded to plaintiffs so they could take more depositions and gain more discovery during the course of the motion to dismiss procedure. They did so.
But your position is basically that there's no evidence that Dr. Garda ever became the borrowed servant of Harris vis-a-vis control of the care she provided that's made the subject of this lawsuit.
That's correct. And the plaintiffs did take Dr. Garda's deposition on this point. Plaintiffs seem to point to the fact that there's, you know, a particular policy in the proceeding, or that governs the procedure at issue in the care. May I answer the question? Or
you can quickly answer the question.
But that policy at Harris or at Claim or JPS isn't substantially different. If one looks at Dr. Garda's deposition testimony, you would see that she squarely testified it's not substantially different. So in the absence of any evidence of actual control, Dr. Garda is entitled to Tort Claims Act immunity.
Thank you very much.
Good morning. May it please the court. In order to prevail on this interlocutory appeal, a claim has to do two things. First, they need to show that the court has jurisdiction by proving that Dr. Garda was an officer or employee of the state or a political subdivision of the state. And then second, of course, they must show that Dr. Garda was acting as an employee of a governmental unit when she delivered baby KAJ at Harris Methodist Hospital. I'm going to address jurisdiction first, since it's obviously the threshold question that has to be answered before we can move on. And I want to start by addressing the waiver argument that was raised in reply, and obviously we haven't had a chance to respond to that. But I would direct the court to the case of Lenoir versus UT Physicians. It's cited in the briefing, not for this proposition.
L-E-N-O-I-R.
You're a better speller than I am. But I would direct the court to that case because they talk about judicial admissions in a similar context. And if you look at what this comes from, actually briefing is what they're alleging the admission was. And the briefing speaks to what their contract says, right? It says their contract characterizes them as a unit of local government, which it does. I don't dispute that that's what their contract says, but that's not the same thing as admitting that they are, you know, unit of local government. So I would make that distinction. And then secondly, an admission that a claim is a unit of local government is not tantamount to an admission that Dr. Garda is an employee of a political subdivision of the state. And I know we're kind of being accused of being ticky-tacky with the language, but these definitions are in the statutes and they're different. They don't mean the same thing. And I think there's overlap, certainly. We were talking about unit of local government and governmental unit. I would look at it as like a Venn diagram, right? Obviously, there's going to be some overlap, but there are places where the legislature has characterized entities as either governmental units or units of local government to give them the liability limits of the Texas Tort Claims Act, which is not the same thing as giving them a immunity from suit.
Well, do you think that most doctors who work for entities like a claim and others that are set up by a county hospital system would be surprised that when they're working at a private hospital that they have no protections that they would otherwise have if they were working at JPS, for example?
No, I don't think so, because when you look at the health and safety code that extends those provisions to contractors or their employees, it's pretty clear that they only get those protections when they're working under that contract for the benefit of that public hospital. Because, to address the broader reason for that is we're trying to give people immunity when they're acting for the government or they're acting as essentially government employees, even though they may have a employer who's a private nonprofit corporation. And so,
of course, and talk about being ticky-tacky with the language, it's not that we're giving people immunity. I mean, there's a presumption that
right.
The sovereign and political subdivisions and all that, they have immunity unless you show a waiver.
Correct. I mean, because it's the official capacity distinction. At a public hospital, you are acting in your official capacity, providing government service, which is, you know, health care that a hospital district is required to provide under the Constitution and so forth. When they go and act at a private entity, they're not providing any governmental service. They're not acting as the government. So by extension, you know, those protections would not apply. And of course, not only is it their assumptions that would play into it, but of course it's the patient's assumptions who are going to a private hospital to have health care and all of a sudden find out that, you know, they're being treated by the government when they may or may not have known that before. And I understand, you know, in Powell, I think it's Powell that discusses, you know, some of the things that the plaintiffs in that case or the patients had signed, acknowledging, I think, the doctor's status as a governmental employee. So obviously those things can be put into the paperwork.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, maybe I'm confused here, but in some ways it sounds like you're conceding that a claim is a governmental unit, but I think your position is actually that, you know, charitable organizations are not governmental units under the Tort Claims Act.
I think that's right. I think as to charitable organizations. Now, they've obviously alleged two bases for their status as a governmental unit. The first would be as a charitable organization, and then the second would be as a management contractor. And so I think, you know, assuming they're a management contractor, they're going to have some immunity when they are, or you know, they and their physicians are going to have immunity at JPS.
Did you find any case law in this idea of this hospital district management contractor? You know, your position was the only way that you actually wear that hat is if you are the sole manager of a hospital, and mm-hmm. that was simply providing services not sufficient, I think, is your position.
Right.
I don't recall the appellant ever citing particular authority that negates that. Do you recall them doing so? And
no, I mean, and then in this court's opinion, in that Baylor Scott and White versus Payton addresses that issue with respect to, I think in that case it was nurses, and they looked at Baylor, who had a contract. I'm forgetting what the public entity was, but they had a contract, and they said, yes, you are a management contractor, but in this case, you weren't managing or operating the hospital. Your nurses were there. You were providing services for the hospital, and so you are not a management contractor entitled to immunity in these circumstances. And then I think if you look at the Act, what the Act would do for those nurses is it makes them employees of the district or whatever the governmental unit is. It doesn't make them employee. You know, it doesn't say as an employee of a claim you are entitled to immunity. You are then, the Act considers them employees of the hospital district. As long as they are providing services under the contract for the benefit of the public hospital. And so that's the distinction I would draw there. If Dr. Garda is delivering babies at JPS, and assuming that contract's in place and she's acting under it, then she would be entitled to the protections of the Tort Claims Act in those circumstances. And I think that speaks to your questions about control and the agreements and how they establish control. Well,
given my question, so do you have an answer with regard to anywhere in the record that would reflect Dr. Garda's privileges at Harris?
We discussed the evidence on our brief in page 26 to 28 and go through some of the provisions.
I think there's a mention of privileges, but it's just a
right. Yes.
But it doesn't actually say how she got them, because
right, I don't.
If she independently was a member of the staff of Harris, for example, before she became an employee of a claim, and a claim was effectively using her ability to practice at Harris, that's what I'm asking
right.
about.
Right. I don't know. There's certainly nothing in the record that speaks to the specifics of how she got her privileges,
okay,
that I'm aware of.
Then second, there is this argument about, was there a pre-existing relationship between Dr. Garda and the mother and child at JPS? Were mother and child being seen at JPS by Dr. Garda, or did the first time they're actually seen for care and treatment occur at Harris?
There's nothing in the record that answers that question, and I don't even know that I can answer it for you going outside of the record. But I know for certain they had.
There's a statement made in opposing counsel's brief that says all of this stuff with regard to a claim performing over at Harris is for the benefit of JPS patients,
right,
so that patients at JPS can be seen at Harris.
Right. I know that
but
statement.
There's no actual statement anywhere in the brief that says that pre-existing relationship, patient-physician relationship, was entered into as part of care being provided through the JPS system. Okay. First time I see anything about anybody, Dr. Garda, taking care of this lady and her baby is at Harris.
That's correct. That's what the record reflects. And I think the statement about, I think there was a statement about a program that benefited JPS patients in a claims briefing. And I think that cited to an affidavit, which I don't think really fully supported that proposition. So, and I'm not aware of any other evidence in the record that would support the argument that this was just a JPS.
Is it even the affidavit from a claim? Does it even say mother and child were patients of a claim at JPS and Dr. Garda, or a claim or JPS at any point in time?
It does not.
And you know, in thinking about this whole idea of control, you know, one thing determining what hospital has to do in order to exert control, you know, if they do take away privileges or they say, look, you can't practice here anymore because you just hurt somebody's infant, which may have happened in this case, I don't know. You know, is that not some form of control from your position?
Yes, it is. I mean, they're never going to exert control over medical decisions, right? And that's always, you know, that's a distinction that the Supreme Court made, I think, in 2003, right? We're not, I mean, otherwise no doctor would ever be entitled to these protections because obviously as physicians, they're always going to be exerting independent medical judgment. So that's not the kind of control we're looking for in these cases. What we're looking for is the degree of control that any hospital is ever going to have over a physician, which is going to be you must abide by our bylaws, our policies and procedures. In this case, there was testimony from Dr. Garda that if she was delivering at Harris Health, she had to abide by their shoulder dystocia policy. Now, I don't know that those policies necessarily, you know, following one policy over another led to the injury, but nonetheless, you know, when she's at JPS, she follows their policies. When she's at a claim, and Harris Health, she follows their policies. And so that's the kind of control, I think, from the Marino case and the Mark case that the Supreme Court has instructed us to look at when we're determining who is the employer.
As an example, does Harris have a separate and distinct policy with regard to cesareans when a decision needs to be made with regard to opting for cesarean as opposed to live birth?
I know they do for shoulder dystocia, so I would assume they would for cesareans as well. How it differs, I don't know, but they have, you know, they have protocols for those types of circumstances that doctors and staff are required to follow. If she's at Harris, she follows their policies. And so to the extent we're going to get, going to move past that, is Harris a governmental unit, and if we're going to kind of examine that employment relationship, then yes, we would look to control. And the more recent authority, intermediate authority, is the Stallworth case out of San Antonio that dealt with it. Somewhat similar. I mean, none of these patterns are completely identical, but I think that's probably the closest where you had a doctor who worked. He was an employee of UT, so so there was no question that that was a governmental unit, but he had performed surgery under his private, plastic surgeon practice. And so
he was a dual employee effectively. Because he had a private practice separate and distinct from his University of Texas practice.
Correct. It's not exactly similar because he was a UT. It was UT physicians or some, his employer. And so it wasn't this situation in the sense he wasn't assigned out by UT. I think he just had his own practice. But nonetheless, the court looked at who had control over him when he was providing the services at issue, and because UT effectively had no control, this was private practice, and I think in that case he would have been subject to the hospital's policies and procedures, although I don't know that that was the nature of the malpractice in that case, but nonetheless, he was not under the control of the governmental entity, and again, they looked at the bylaws and the procedures and the things that he had to do and to determine whose procedures is he following, and it wasn't the governmental entities. And I think there's also a distinction between paid service and control. I don't want to say distinction, but a distinction in our argument, in the sense that the statute requires both, right? You have to be in the paid service, but you're also going to look to which entity has the actual right to control the details of the work. So just being in paid service isn't enough. And I think, I'm not going to say that Powell was incorrectly decided, but obviously it was decided before the court, and even the parties had the benefit of some of the Texas Supreme Court's more recent opinions. And so the evidence wasn't necessarily there. Would it have been developed under different authorities? Perhaps. But I think if I had to point to one area of that Powell Court's analysis that is perhaps not, doesn't survive the later opinions, it's kind of looking at that the payment of evidence, or they paid the salary, or they, they provided insurance, or those sort of administrative tasks the Supreme Court later held or not.
Are there any allegations in this claim, and I know that nurses and Harris are not up here, but are there any allegations that at any point in time, due to the care that was being or not being provided by Dr. Garda, the nurses should have invoked the chain of authority and attempted to bring in the chief of staff or somebody of that nature to effectively come in and either replace Dr. Garda or to help inform Dr. Garda's care by using the staff requirements?
There may be...
There's a term for that, and I've gone blank on it. I want to say chain of custody, but
the chain of command. The
chain of command. Bingo, thank you. I knew it was right, there.
Yes. There may be a general allegation to that effect in the complaint. I don't think there's anything more specific than that that's developed at this point. Obviously, there's not a lot of discovery that's gone on.
But that goes back to a peer review argument. Sure. With regard to if in fact Dr. Garda is subject to a chain of command type of situation, then correct, that would be an exercise of actual control. Would
correct.
Not.
Even if that wasn't what actually transpired, I think you could say if that's what happened, certainly, if they go up the chain of command, they're going up the chain of command at their own hospital. They're not going to call a claim.
Or JPS.
Or JPS to have them come in and override whatever decision Dr. Garda is making. I think just the nature of how that goes down towards the end of a labor, there may not be time for the nurses to invoke the chain of command. But there could be decisions made earlier that would lead to this, shoulder dystocia that perhaps they should have intervened earlier. I think the argument would perhaps be to maybe have a cesarean or something like that.
It seemed to me, and maybe I read this wrong, but it seemed to be that their position is that the Acclaim-Harris agreement has some language in it that talks about independent contractor, and then you distinguish it and say, well, that's not actually the case. It's independent physician, and then you kind of start to distinguish it, but I can't really remember how you do that.
Sure. So I think the independent practitioner language picks up on the, I think it's Mark versus Steele, that Texas Supreme Court case, saying a doctor can still be an independent practitioner and be an employee for Tort Claims Act purposes, because obviously the doctor is always going to be exercising some independent medical judgment, which is different than sort of the independent contractor type relationship. And I think, you know, if you look at a claims agreement with Dr. Garda, even her employment agreement, they acknowledge that she's an independent practitioner as well. They may not use that exact word, but it's the same concept, which is you're the doctor. We're not telling you how to do your job as a doctor just because we're paying your salary and employing you, which is, I think, a little bit of a distinction perhaps between how we would ordinarily look at employment in the common law context, because we're looking for that right to control. But I see I'm almost out of time, so unless the court has further questions, I will just say we would ask that the opinion below, we would ask the case be dismissed for lack of jurisdiction or alternatively the opinion be. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Rebuttal?
Justice Kerr, in response to one of the questions that you asked, did Dr. Garda or claim physicians expect to have immunity when performing providing care at Harris? The answer is absolutely yes. It's part of the record in the Acclaim-Harris agreement. It's part of the record in Dr. Garda's employment agreement with Acclaim. It's very well set out in all of the agreements in the record. In follow-up to Justice Birdwell's questions on peer review, I don't believe any of that is in this record for us. To the extent that plaintiff wanted to use that as evidence of some control by Harris over Dr. Garda, it was plaintiff's burden to bring that as a fact question. And plaintiff didn't do that. Plaintiff was given plenty of opportunity for more discovery during the dismissal proceeding. I think there were three hearings on the issue. And so based on what we have in the record, we thought the Harris Acclaim agreement, which specifically states at page 95 of the clerk's record, Acclaim and the physicians made available by Acclaim are at all times independent practitioners. Group and physicians, this is Acclaim, shall perform the coverage services free of any direction or control by hospital, Harris. Nothing in this agreement shall be construed as giving hospital the degree of control necessary to create an employer-employee relationship. So once that agreement was part of the record, plaintiff had to show some control over Dr. Garda by Harris to the exclusion of a claim. And plaintiff didn't meet that evidentiary burden here. And for that reason, the trial court should have dismissed Dr. Garda from this case. Also, to touch on one item that was discussed during counsel's argument, Dr. Garda, unlike the case of the Stallworth case or the other cases supported in Appellee's brief, Dr. Garda was solely employed by a claim. The evidence is not disputed on that. Her sole employment was a claim, so she fully expected whether a claim asked her to perform services, provide services at Hospital A, Hospital B, she expected to be afforded the immunity granted to Acclaim and JPS while performing those services, because that's all part of the political subdivision of the state's services to the county.
Okay, so with whom did the mother and child have the physician-patient relationship before the Harris delivery?
I do not know whether there is something specific on that issue in the record before this court, outside the record.
Okay, so this is a Harris patient, and just because Dr. Garda shows up to do the delivery, she's entitled to immunity, with the patient having absolutely no clue that they're being taken care of by somebody who's subject to immunity?
During the admission process, all of that is made clear to the patient on the...
Where's that in the record?
It is. They signed a form.
There's a form cited. I can't give you the exact page of the record, but we cited to the admission form in our brief, where it is made clear that there's independent services provided by other physicians. That informs plaintiff of that fact. We do have evidence in the record that...
Does it specifically mention the JPS system?
I would have to provide that in a subsequent brief, but I believe,
I believe it does.
Okay.
I do know that plaintiff was seen subsequent to the treatment at JPS as a JPS patient by claim. That's in the record.
Did Dr. Garda see her at JPS, or was it somebody else at a claim? Or do you know?
I don't know that.
Okay.
I know that she was seen at JPS.
You know, I mean, Harris is across the street from JPS, you know. And so from a geographical standpoint, I keep thinking to myself, you know, what if Dr. Garda had been loaned to some hospital in Galveston, and then this would have happened there. And you know, and your argument would be that she would be covered. She would be protected because she just happens to be employed by a claim. And, you know, I mean, that would be your position, wouldn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. And certainly, now, in your hypothetical, we'd have to examine whatever contract there is between the Galveston Hospital and a claim to see what it said and determine, you know, the facts and circumstances of that case. But here, the record shows that we have a contract that specifically denounces the amount of control necessary to get around the Tort Claims Act. And plaintiff had the burden in response to that to provide some evidence of control, and it didn't do so. And so in light of this record, dismissal should be.
Thank you. Your time's up. All right. We appreciate the oral argument. It's been very helpful. Your case is submitted.